And we can start today with chapter 4, which is about transcriptional regulation. And this is what we will be discussing throughout this week. We'll go through different steps of transcriptional regulation, starting with the approaches that we use to study transcriptional regulation and then really going into the details of this process. It's the part I work on and I've been working on for my entire life, so I enjoy teaching this chapter. And please feel free to interrupt, ask questions as usual if there are parts that are not clear or you want more depth about some of the concepts. So why do we study transcriptional regulation? The answer is obvious. Understanding how gene expression is regulated allows us to understand how the morphologic and functional differences among cell types, among tissues, is achieved. And so if you think about cells that are morphologically and functionally highly different, such as neurons up here, or cells from the adipose tissue, adipocytes here, their function is extremely different. One has to transmit information, the other one has to store lipids. And they achieve this functional specificity by highly specialized differences in gene expression, because if these are from the same individual, they all encode, they all have the same genome, but it's expressed in a different manner. Same thing if we compare differences between healthy cells and unhealthy cells. So if you consider, for example, the one up here is a cell from, it's a breast cancer cell. So if you compare epithelial cells from a normal breast or cells from a breast cancer sample or cell line, there are differences in the way in which the genome is expressed, leading to different function, different properties in cell growth and proliferation, and so on and so forth. Obviously, the changes in gene expression are not regulated only at the transcriptional level. There are multiple levels of regulation of gene expression. We start with transcriptional controls when at the level of transcriptional regulation from the gene to the primary transcript. However, there are a number of additional levels of regulation in terms of RNA processing, RNA transport, translational control, post-translational control at the level of protein modification. So I'm not trying in any way to say that the only important level of regulation is the transcriptional one. However, one has to consider the fact that it is the primary event. There is no way to go through the other level of regulation if transcripts are not first transcribed. And so it's a critical point of regulation in terms of gene expression. And it's because of that, it's extremely regulated. Our understanding of how transcription is regulated is growing exponentially in the last few years. So, in terms of textbook, you can still refer to this review by Mike Levine and Robert Bob Tijan that I believe you have already seen in one of the previous modules with Professor Bartoli. And I think it makes, it's a very well-written review, and there are some concepts that are made extremely clear, especially in the abstract that we have here and the introduction. Because it clearly points to the fact that there are a number of levels of regulation that are present within the transcriptional control that allows the complexity in terms of transcriptional complexity, the one that we discussed last week, but also in terms of different regulation in different tissues, different stages of development. And so if you look here, this abstract is really well crafted because it clearly shows uh, What is the main question when we are addressing the complexity of transcriptional regulation? And so it first points to the fact that recent comparative genome analysis have led to an increased understanding of genome complexity, which is what we have discussed last week, and the fact that the genome is pervasively transcribed and it's transcribed in a way that was not appreciated before. So that when we increase complexity in organism, going from, for example, from worm to human, there is really not a big change in the number of genes, but the big changes are in the way in which their expression is regulated and the number of transcripts that are produced from those genes. The second thing is that in order to achieve that complexity, there are different levels of regulation that need to be considered. And so one is the presence of a multitude of regulatory elements. So the first thing is the presence of regulatory elements in the genome that allows to regulate transcription in a specific manner. And so promoter, enhancer, different transcription factor binding sites. So these are physical elements in the genome that allows transcriptional regulation. And there is a multitude of them. So the large complexity of physical elements is one of the aspects that allows for transcriptional regulation. The second thing is the complexity of the machinery. So increased complexity and functional diversification of transcriptional machinery that recognize these physical elements. So the second level of complexity is the number of proteins that can bind to these physical elements. So we have tons of promoter enhancer elements on the genome, as well as tons of proteins, transcriptional proteins that have to bind or to interact in some manner to these physical elements to regulate transcription. And then the third level of complexity is due to the high-order spatial organization of these genetic elements. So it's not only the presence of these elements in the genome, but it's also where they are located. And whether they are located in proximity of the genes or far away from them, whether there are three-dimensional structure within the nucleus that allows different elements to become close and to regulate different genes at different times. So these are the three elements that we'll be discussing this week: the physical elements, the promoter, the enhancer, the transcription factor binding sites. Second, the machineries that bind to these transcriptional elements. And then third, the spatial regulation of where are they located. Are they close to the genes? Are they far to the genes? Do they come together at some point? Okay? So, as I was saying before, transcriptional regulation is clearly not the only level of regulation of gene expression, but is a critical one, and that's how this review starts. So the first sentence is transcriptional regulation is the premier mechanism underlying differential gene activity in animal development and disease. And so okay, so actually this is easier. Thank you. You made me realize that I don't have to kill myself. So the key here is differential gene activity. I don't think I need to explain this concept, but the problem is not only understanding how transcription happens, how it occurs, how the RNA polymerase does its job, but it's also to understand how different genes can be regulated in a differential manner, how RNA polymerase choose which genes to bind to at a certain time, how it decide whether it has to express a lot, a little, fast, slow. So the key of studying transcriptional regulation is understanding how different genes are differentially regulated, not only how the process of transcription itself can happen. Okay, so as I said, there are different steps of transcription, of gene expression regulation. One of them is transcriptional regulation, but even within transcriptional regulation, there are different levels. Transcription is a complicated process, And so it can be regulated at different steps. In general, transcription, if you think about what transcription is the generation of an RNA copy from the DNA template. And so the main player in this process is an RNA polymerase enzyme that binds to a transcription unit and then, using the DNA as a template, moves along the DNA and produces a transcript, so an RNA copy of the template. Now, this process is formed by a number of steps, the first one being initiation, when RNA polymerase bind to the transcriptional star site and then is ready to start. The second one is elongation, when it clears from the promoter and then starts moving along the transcript and producing the RNA copy. And then there is a termination step when RNA polymerase is stopped and is detached from the genome. Now, each of these steps is regulated, but when we talk about transcriptional regulation, we are mostly focusing on these initial phases. There is some work done on how termination is regulated on different elements at the 3' end of genes that regulate the stop of RNA polymerase. And there is some new work that suggests that there may be connection between the termination phase and the reinitiation. There may be spatial regulation of this, but it's not a very well... Good one. It's not a very well-studied process right now. When we talk about transcriptional regulation, we are mostly focusing on these two steps, the recognition of promoters by RNA polymerase and the beginning of the transcriptional process, which is regulated in a number of manner, together with the transition from the initiation into the elongation phase. As I said, all these processes depend on one main enzymatic function, which is the function of the RNA polymerase, which can use the DNA as a template to make an RNA copy. I don't think I need to go through the process to the specifics of our RNA polymerase work. I'm sure you have studied that before. One point that I want to make is that there are different types of polymerases. I'm sure you have studied that as well, RNA polymerase 1, 2, and 3. We will be mostly focusing on transcriptional regulation by RNA polymerase 2, which is the RNA polymerase that transcribed all the process RNA and a lot of non-coding RNA. There are also RNA pol 1, which mostly regulate the transcription of ribosomal RNA and is found at the ribosomes, as well as RNA pol 3, which transcribed, which is widely used and transcribed not only the tRNA, but also some ribosomal RNA and some small nuclear RNA. So, again, I'm not trying to make the point that RNA pol 2 is the only one that is regulated and the only one that is important, but is the most studied. And so we'll study the process of transcriptional regulation, mostly focusing on RNA pol 2. I'll point out in a couple of places where there are differences known with the other polymerases, but we'll be mostly talking about RNA pol 2. Now, even though the main enzymatic activity is the one of RNA pol 2, RNA pol 2 doesn't work alone by any mean. And if you if you consider this picture, this is a highly simplified picture where only RNA pol 2 is represented as moving along the DNA template. However, a much more real picture is one like this, where RNA pol 2 is just one of a very large complex of proteins that include a number of different players, a lot of them carrying enzymatic activities. So even though the main enzymatic activity that is necessary for producing the RNA transcript is the one of RNA polymerase, it would be a huge mistake to think that that's the only enzymatic activity that is present at the transcriptional star site or that is required for transcription to happen. There are a number of enzymatic activities that we'll go through that are included in these large complexes, and that allows for the opening of the DNA template, for the regulation of histone modification, for the post-translational regulation of different transcription factors, as well as RNA polymerase itself. So what are the players that work together with the RNA polymerase? The factors that are required to regulate transcription belong to five different classes. In addition to the polymerase itself, there are general transcription factors, mediator complex, DNA binding transcription factor, as well as a multitude of co-repressor and co-activators. So if we look at this list, there are basically two different classes. In addition to RNA polymerase, there are two different classes of proteins present here. One is transcription factors that recognize the DNA in a sequence-specific manner. So these are considered general transcription factors, and we'll see what they are. Then there is the multitude of transcription factor as you normally think about them, so AP1, NF-kappa-B, P53, all those. The main feature about them is that they are able to recognize sequence-specific response element on DNA, and therefore allows for targeting transcription to specific location in the genome. RNA polymerase per se or other co-repressor and co-activators don't recognize the DNA, and so are the specificity of gene regulation would not be possible if there weren't proteins involved in this process that can regulate specific sequences on the DNA. The second class is instead is proteins that don't bind to DNA. So mediator, co-repressor, co-activators, these are all proteins that are important to regulate transcription, often carry enzymatic activities, but they don't bind DNA specifically. And so if you look at the picture that we looked at before, these are proteins that don't touch the DNA or they make non-specific interaction with histones or with the DNA itself, but they don't carry sequence specificity. Okay, so if we think about transcriptional regulation in this way, you can see that there are two main classes of proteins that we want to study. One that regulates transcription by binding to a specific sequence on DNA, and the second one that binds by being recruited through this transcription factor, or at least interacting with these DNA binding specific transcription factors. To simplify things as much as possible, one could think of transcriptional regulation as a switch, and this is something that was mostly done when considering bacterial transcription, where the process is more simple. But I think we can use this similarity, this metaphor, in considering also transcription from higher organism, because it allows us to think about which are the approaches that we need to use to study these proteins. So one can think of transcription as a binary switch, which is composed by two elements. One is the proteins, and the other is the binding site, the sequence-specific element on the DNA. They come together in some way, and then the assembly of these complexes on DNA is what allows transcription to occur through interaction with and regulation of RNA polymerase. And so if we think about the approaches that we want to use to study transcription, we need to have a number of approaches that can can allow us to investigate two different things. One is the physical interaction between these two elements, these two components of the switch. So on one side, we want to look at how they interact, where they interact, how they interact, what is the specificity of the interaction. The other, the second question is not their physical interaction, but their functional interaction. And so how is this interaction, how is the recruitment of these proteins on DNA allowing transcription to be regulated? And so we need two different type of approaches. And this is what we'll be discussing this morning, approaches that can be used to study physical interaction between the two, between DNA and protein, and then functional approaches that can be used to read out the functional effect of this protein-DNA interaction. Okay, so starting with the physical interaction, the first thing to consider is the electrophoretic mobility shift assay, or you may also know it as band shift. It's been widely used to study transcriptional regulation for many, many years, and you find it in a lot of papers that that have elucidated the principle of transcriptional regulation. So we'll go through the protocols. Just one more thing about this this assay. What I would like to do this morning is to really show you the how these different approaches work, and then we'll get back to them as we go through the paper and through the principle of transcriptional regulation to see how they have been used. Some of them are still currently used all the time. Some of them are have been evolved or are. Have been abandoned. However, I think it's important to know how they work because as you read the papers, those are the approaches that are have been used to address the question that we'll be looking into. And so in order to be able to read the, critically the papers, you need to understand how the approaches work. Okay, so going back to EMSA, this is, as I said, is a technique that allows us to study the physical interaction. You don't get any functional information from a band shift assay. What it allows you to do is to see whether a piece of DNA interacts with a specific protein. That's basically the type of question that you can answer. And it's based on, it's a basically a retardation assay. So the idea is that you have a piece of DNA that can be a sequence that you want to test, a specific portion of a promoter or a synthetic sequence that you have made, a transcription factor binding site. So you design the piece of DNA that you are going to use in the assay. And then you have the protein, which can be either purified protein. If you are studying a specific transcription factor, it can be purified transcription factor, or it can be nuclear extract from your cells of interest. And so you can use a complex of proteins and test their binding to DNA. You put them together, and then the DNA is labeled. Most of the old papers, it was labeled through in a radioactive manner. However, now there are versions that have been developed with biotin labeling. So in some more recent paper, you can find biotinylated gel shift. And the idea is that the free oligo will move much faster on a gel. So you separate, you first allow the complex to assemble in vitro in the tube, and then you separate it on an electrophoresis and an acrylamide gel. And the DNA by itself will move much faster than the DNA complex with the proteins. And so if you look at the gel and as an autoradiograph after exposing it, you'll see that the free oligo is moved down here very fast, whereas the oligo that is complex with different proteins is retarded on the gel, and the retardation is the amount of retardation is comparable with the size of the proteins. So strengths of these methods are that you can detect low abundance DNA binding protein from lysate. So even proteins that are not highly abundant in a nuclear extract can be tested in this way, because even a little bit of protein that is bound to your DNA will lead to a retardation, and so can be seen on a gel. It also allows to test binding affinity with different mutations, because it's a test tube and you design the oligo that you are going to use in the assay. You can test all kind of different mutations, and that's one of the main question that has been addressed by these methods. If you wanted to test the specificity of a transcription factor binding site to its response element, you can really design oligos where each base pair is mutated by one in order to understand the importance of each residue in the DNA binding interaction process. Limitation is that is an in vitro assay, so you are not testing what's happening in vivo. You are just testing that one protein can bind to a certain sequence when they are put together. It doesn't tell you that that's really happening in vivo. How do you prove that the assay is working and that the retardation that you are observing is specific and it's not just some random effect of proteins aggregating together with the DNA? So there are a number of controls that people usually add when they are doing band shift experiment, and they fall into two categories. The first one is competition assays. So if you use an excess amount of another oligo, you can displace the protein from binding to your labeled oligo, right? So you can use that by comparing the ability of a wild type oligo or a mutant oligo to displace the binding to your probe. And that allows you to verify specificity. If the retardation band you are observing is just some general aggregate, it will not be displaced by the wild type or the mutant oligo in a different manner. Whereas if the binding is specific and it's due to the binding, for example, of a transcription factor to its response element, only an oligo with the same sequence is going to be able to displace it, whereas an oligo with a random sequence or a sequence that is specifically mutated in the transcription factor binding site will not be able to displace it. The second type of controls is what it's called super shift assays, and that's basically adding another protein on top of the complex to make it even slower. That's the idea. It's pretty simple. If you have a complex that is formed by your protein of interest that is bound to the oligo and it's running at this level on the gel, if you add on top of it another protein that binds to the first one, then your oligo is going to be retarded even more. And so if you add if this yellow thing here, it's an antibody that is specific for the blue protein, then you can verify that the protein that is bound here, it's really the protein that you think. So these two type of control are actually addressing two different kind of questions. The competition assays are more important to prove the specificity of the binding to the oligo rather than some non-specific association. Whereas the super shift allows you to identify the protein that is bound to the oligo. And so this is just an example to show you what a gel shift looks like. I thought that instead of taking a picture from one of the many papers, I showed you a gel shift. I thought I was going to teach in the academia, which is where this gel shift was made, because it's one of the gel shifts that I did during my thesis work, and Professor De Bortoli laboratory at that time was in the academia. And so we ran lots of these gels in order to get this picture, because one of the limitations of gel shift is that they are very finicky experiments. It's really hard to make them work. The interaction between the protein and the DNA has to happen in cold, so you have to work in the cold room for hours, and then very often the association breaks when you are trying to run it on the gels, so gels need to be run a specific time at a specific temperature for a specific current. So it's not an easy experiment to put together. However, the results are very important, because it was the only way that was available at that time prior to the development of chips to study interaction between transcription factors and DNA. And so at that time we were studying tyrosine receptor in breast cancer, the ERB2 receptor, and how it was regulated by estrogens. And we had found a region on the promoter of ERB2 that we thought was important for the regulation. And we thought that that particular piece of the promoter was bound by a factor that is called AP2. So the point of this experiment was to show that this piece of DNA was bound by something that was present in the nuclear extract, as well as that something was AP2. And so I show you this gel because it shows the all the different type of controls that we discussed before, and also the type of problems that you can find when you are looking at the gel shift on a paper. So the first thing is these first two lanes. As you can see, if we use the recombinant protein, so if we just take AP2 and we put it together with our sequence of DNA, the first thing we wanted to show was whether the two things could interact. And so you can see that there is a lot of free probe down here, but then there is a shift, and so these represent AP2 binding to our sequence of interest. Then in order to really confirm that it was AP2, we ran a super shift with the antibody and show that this is shifted up, so it's really AP2 binding to the binding site. However, when we run the same experiment here in lane C using nuclear extract from the cells that we were interested in, so breast cancer cells, you can see there are two different type of retardation. There is a band down here, which is actually was the most predominant band, the one that we were seeing all the time. And then there was a higher band that, as in terms of retardation, was reminiscent of the AP2 binding to that specific region. And so a big problem for us was to understand what this was, whether this was a specific band or not, whether there were other factors that we were not aware of that were binding. And so that's why we ran some of the controls that we just discussed. And so here we ran controls with competitors, and we could show that if we were using different competitor sequences, we could displace only the upper band but not the bottom one. And so this was an indication that the bottom band was some specific binding due to protein present in those particular extracts that would aggregate together and bind to that sequence. But it was not a sequence-specific binding because we could not displace it with the specific competitor. The other experiment that we ran was to run a super shift, just like here, but now doing it on the nuclear extract. And so this again proved that only the upper band represent binding of AP2 to that specific sequence, whereas the lower band is something else. And so this is an example of the type of controls that you run for a gel shift experiment. Now, gel shifts are not widely used anymore. You can find them, but they are not widely used because of the advance of other approaches. However, there is a methodology that has been developed using the concept of the band shift, which is the use of protein binding microarrays. And it's a way to make the gel shift high throughput in a way. And so people have built microarrays where they can, just like the DNA microarrays we discussed last week, where you can print on an array a large number of sequences. And so the oligos that you use for the gel shift are not in solution now, but they are bound on an array platform. And then you can use transcription factors that are labeled with some kind of tag to hybridize this microarray, and then you wash it, just like a regular DNA microarray that we discussed before, and then you identify which are the sequences that have been bound by that specific transcription factor. And so this type of study, these type of studies have been used, for example, to identify the properties of homodimer versus heterodimer binding to different type of sequences, because on a single microarray, people can print all kind of different permutation of a specific sequence. And so try the homodimer alone, the homodimer with different possible the transcription factor binding site alone, together with the repetition of the same transcription factor binding site at a certain distance, include linkers of different spaces, or try to see how the binding of different transcription factor is modified if they are put together on the same sequences. And instead of having to run millions of bend shift, which, as I said, it's not a simple task, you could run it in one single run on a microarray and obtain a large number of information. And so this is something that you can find in the literature that has been used for addressing transcription factor specificity. Okay. Another way to address the physical interaction between DNA, pieces of DNA, and proteins is DNA footprinting. This is also something that has been widely used in the area of transcriptional regulation. And here the main idea is that when a factor is bound to DNA, the DNA is protected from DNA's digestion. And so if you have a population of genomic DNA that you are interested in, and you label it, and then you either expose it to binding to your protein of interest or leave it as it is, then you can compare how these two populations are digested if you expose them to a mild DNase 1 digestion. And so this one can be digested at every single position. And so if you run on a gel all the different species that come out of this digestion, then you'll find basically one lane for each base that is cut. And clearly that's why you need to do a limited DNA digestion, because if you do a very extensive DNA digestion, you just digest everything. So you want to use condition in which you are mildly digesting the DNA, so that only a certain portion of certain percentage of your population is digested at each single position, and you have enough to run it on the gel. Otherwise you will get only things that are fully digested. The difference between this sample and these samples is that here the area that is covered by your protein of interest is protected from digestion, and so when you run it on the gel, you will have a hole that corresponds to the area that is protected, and that's why it's called footprinting, because it's the footprint of your protein of interest on that piece of the genome. And this is what a DNA footprinting gel looks like. So you have different lanes. In each of the lanes, you run your samples, and then usually people run on the side. Okay, consider that we are talking about pre-sequencing time, so we are talking about Sanger sequencing, and so people were usually running the results of your DNA footprinting experiment next to a regular Sanger sequencing, so that you can understand from the position of the different bases where the footprinting was occurring on your sequence. And so here you can see that when you add the TBP to this lysate here, TBP is the Tata binding protein that we'll discuss in a little bit, you obtain a footprint here, all of a sudden this area cannot be digested anymore, and so you add additional band up here because all of a sudden there is a limit to where the DNA start to be digested. And so this is considered the limit of the footprinting, the one on the top and the one on the bottom, and then there is an area that is protected. And this is, in this particular case, it's data box which is bound by TBP. When you add some other transcriptional factors, the TAF, then you add an additional footprinting in this region, and that's where the initiator is. So this is the type of result that you can get from a footprinting experiment. Okay, CHIP. Now everything, let's see if I can, start the CHIP and then we'll take a break. So CHIP is chromatin immunoprecipitation analysis, and I don't know if you've already gone through the basics with Professor De Bartoli, maybe just a little bit. So it really changed the way in which people have studied transcriptional regulation. It started to be developed around the 2000, more or less. The main advantage of chromatin immunoprecipitation analysis is that it allows you to study, again, physical interaction, DNA-protein interaction, but in vivo in cells. And so that's the big advantage of CHIP. The process is, the idea is pretty simple, and is that you have a number of proteins that are normally bound to DNA in vivo in your cells or tissue of interest, and you you want to take a snapshot of what's bound on DNA at a certain time point. And so you cross-link, you chemically cross-link cells. Usually we use formaldehyde, but there are a couple of other ways to do it. It's important to remember that these are cross-linked, so you are not looking at a dynamic approach. You cannot measure things in real time unless you run CHIP at specific time points. Each CHIP is a snapshot of which proteins are bound to DNA in that specific cells in that specific condition. And the advantage is that you can do it in vivo. So this is not an approach where you take the DNA and you take the protein and you mix together and then you see whether they can bind, but it's an approach where you fix the cells as they are and then you look at them. It's like a way, an amplified way to look at what is binding on DNA in the cells. And so that tells you not only whether it can bind, but also whether it does bind in that specific condition. And then the process is pretty simple. You have to identify what these locations are. And so you break the DNA, you fragment the chromatin, and then you immunoprecipitate. You do an immunoprecipitation with an antibody against your protein of interest. And because the protein is cross-linked, so let's say you are interested in this orange protein, which is, for example, a transcription factor. Because the protein is cross-linked to the DNA, when you do the immunoprecipitation with your antibody, you bring down not only the protein, but also the DNA that is attached to it. And then you visualize it in some way. Basic CHIP approach is then to use primers to amplify a specific sequence. Genome-wide approaches like ChIP-seq is then to sequence, and we'll go through that. But the idea, the main idea is that you cross-link things, so you fix them in a certain state, and then you immunoprecipitate with an antibody. So, as I said, the strengths are that you can look at things in vivo for the first time. Before, we were only be able to use things, use approaches where we were looking at protein-DNA interaction in vitro. And also that detection by PCR is sensitive. Weakness is, it's not an easy protocol. It takes some time to optimize it, especially if you go from one cell type to another cell type or one tissue to another tissue. There are a lot of optimization steps. But mostly the main limitation is that it requires very good antibodies. So the main thing for a CHIP to work is that the antibody has to be able to work. And there isn't a good way to know whether an antibody can work in chip or not unless you try it. And often if you don't have positive control, it's hard to know whether it's not working because you are not looking at the right target, or it's not working because the antibody is not chip grade. So one way in which people think of which people try to assess the quality of the antibody for chip is to know whether they work in immunoprecipitation. So good antibodies for IP sometimes are also good antibody for chips. However, one thing that you have to remember about chip is that because the way in which the protocol works is that you first fix everything and cross-link protein to DNA, you also cross-link complexes. So you cross-link proteins to each other. And so often epitopes that would be available on a protein when it's in solution in a normal immunoprecipitation are masked when that protein is cross-linked on DNA. If you have a big complex of proteins, it's very possible that an epitope is hidden inside the complex, and that's why sometimes antibodies don't work for chip. Okay, so as I said, there are a number of steps at which you need to optimize the protocol. The first thing is the cross-linking itself. You don't want to over-cross-link, because if you over-cross-link, you get everything in the nucleus cross-linked together. Nor you want to under-cross-link, because you may miss protein-DNA interaction. And depending on whether you are interested in proteins that bind directly to DNA, or you are interested in protein that bind indirectly, so transcription factors versus cofactor, cross-linking condition may differ a little bit. If you think about it, it's looking at the protein that binds directly to DNA, it's much easier than looking at something that binds at two or three steps above, and so the cross-linking has to be stronger. The second thing is the fragmentation. At the beginning, people were using just a probe sonicator to sonicate chromatin. This was quite efficient. We all use it. However, there are problems in reproducing the same result from one experiment to the other, because depending on each time how your probe works, how long you sonicate, the heat that is produced during the sonication that will affect the quality of the protein in your samples, there is a lot of variability in there. So now there are sonicators that are commercially available that are more consistent. There are two or three different brands, and the idea is that they are water bath, sometimes already cold, sometimes you put ice in it, and then they work with waves, sound waves, and so they break the sonicate the chromatin in that way, and you can calibrate the type of wave and the length of the wave and the interval. And so once you have set up your condition for that specific cell type or that specific tissue, you can repeat each experiment in the same way, so the reproducibility is higher. And then after you break the chromatin, the size that you want to break it into is about 500 base pair, 200 to 600 base pair, so you need to check how many cycles of sonication you need to do to achieve that size. Then you can do your immunoprecipitation with the antibody of interest. We already discussed the problems with the antibody choice. And then you can capture the immunoprecipitated material with different type of beads. So there are represented here is a magnetic capture. So you use magnetic beads that bind to the antibody and bring down the immunoprecipitated material. Or you can use agarose beads, just like when you do a normal immunoprecipitation. And there are pros and cons with both approaches. The magnetic purification is it's cleaner, so you can achieve better purification and you have less background. However, you also recover less material. So if you're working with limited samples, this can be a problem. Or when you're doing ChIP-seq experiment and you wanna have as much as possible to sequence, this can be a limiting factor. Agarose is the opposite. You have better recovery, a higher yield. However, you have a higher background just because of non-specific binding to the agarose species. Okay, and then the last thing is which kind of controls you need to include in a chip experiment. As I said, one of the main problem is that sometimes you don't know whether your chip, your antibody is a quality grade chip antibody, whether it works or not. So it's a good idea to include the positive controls of things that you know should be immunoprecipitated, so that you know whether the protocol itself is working or not. And so normal, usual choices are immunoprecipitating for Pol2 or for histone marked antibody. Those are things that are widely present in the genome. The chip antibody works well, and so that can be used as a positive control. The other thing is controls for unrelated genomic region that should not bind. So this is important to understand whether what you are looking at is specific binding to your region of interest, or whether you have not, if you don't sonicate enough and you have very large pieces, you can imagine that you can have a piece that is 2, 3, 4 kb long, and it has a binding site for your protein of interest in some point, but you immunoprecipitate it all because you immunoprecipitate the fragment of DNA that is bound to your protein of interest, right? And so when you do the PCR, you PCR here. You want to know whether your protein is bound here to the promoter of gene X, right? But if you have not sonicated well enough, you will bring down this piece, even if the protein binds completely in another location. However, if you have sonicated well enough and these pieces are small enough, then your immunoprecipitation will bring down this piece, but not this piece, and so you will get a negative result. So what you want to do when you do a chip experiment is to include primers that are amplify your region of interest, as well as primer that amplify other regions, maybe downstream of your regulatory region or in a completely different genomic location, so that you can control that the binding that you observe is specific to the region you are interested in, and it's not due to insufficient cross-linking. Okay, and then what else? And then you usually do an IP for IgG, just as a negative control. That should be your background level of immunoprecipitation. And then the regular PCR controls to make sure that the PCR is working. Okay, so we can take a little break and then we'll continue with the ChIP-seq after. Okay, so let me get a little bit better into how you read out the result of a chip, because I think I was pretty fast at the end on the control, so it may have been a little bit confusing. And anyway, we needed to move forward to the global screening method. So the basic readout of a chip experiment, a normal hand chip experiment, is a PCR. And the idea is that you start with the protocol as we discussed before. You are interested in knowing where a certain protein binds. So you sonicate the chromatin, immunoprecipitate pieces of DNA that are attached to your protein of interest by doing an immunoprecipitation for an antibody. And then the question is, how do you evaluate whether the protein binds to a certain gene or not? And so what we used to do at the beginning was to interrogate single genes. So you were interested in knowing whether protein X was bound to the promoter of a certain gene, for example, gene A and gene B. And so you do the chip, as we discussed, we immunoprecipitate using an antibody against protein X. First you sonicate, so you sonicate pieces of DNA that hopefully are small enough, like this. And then you wanna see whether the protein is bound to your gene of interest. And so you design specific primers that will amplify the region that you are interested in. And so you design a couple of primers that amplify this specific promoter, another couple of primers, so this is one and two, another couple of primers, three and four, that amplify this other gene that you are interested in, and then another couple of primers that amplify an unrelated region of the genome that has nothing to do with gene A and gene B, and these are five and six. Okay, and so the first way to do it was to take the material that you get at the end of the old chip protocol and then run a PCR with this primer, and this primer. Now, if the result was a gel like this, where one and two was giving you a band, three and four was not giving you anything, or maybe a little faint signal, and then five and six the same, the way to interpret this experiment was, okay, my protein is binding to gene A, to the promoter of gene A, but it's not binding to the promoter of gene B. And the experiment worked well. This binding is probably specific, because if I amplify a region that is unrelated, I don't get any signal. So that was the initial way to assess the result of a chip. Now, the limitation of this approach is that you can look only at a limited number of genes. Two, three, maybe four. The chip reaction at the end is eluted in about 25, 50 microliter. So you finish up your material pretty fast by doing PCRs. You cannot test more than three, four genes. Okay? So people realize pretty quickly that there was a wealth of information in this chip material, but we were analyzing only a very limited amount of it. Because in the material that you had immunoprecipitated, there was basically every single region in the genome that was bound to your protein of interest. But you were analyzing only two, three genes that you were interested in. All the rest of the information was lost. And so people started immediately, within a year or two, to try to develop ways to interrogate the binding of the protein of interest to the whole genome, to read what the information that was encoded, that was present in your tube at the end of the chip. And so a different number of approaches were developed. One first way to do it was to use microarrays and hybridize all these pieces of DNA that you were getting out of the chip protocol to a microarray and see where these sequences would hybridize. So this was called chip-on-chip and was initially pretty popular. One of the problems, this is a similar approach where people were adapting the technology that we discussed the other day for CAGE and SAGE, where you take all the sequences that you get from your cDNA library prep and then you concatenize them into plasmid and sequence them. And this was also tried as a way to read out all the chip results. The main limitation of these approaches was the cost. So when I was a grad student, there were a few postdocs in my lab that worked on setting up chip-on-chip in the lab. And the main problem was the printing of this chip, because basically you needed to print homemade chips where oligos that represented all the regulatory region in the cells were printed. So first of all, this was not a real genome-wide approach, because only the sequences that were printed on the array could be interrogated. But also because printing chips with all these oligos costed a fortune. And so basically there were grants that were written just to print the microarray. So this was a developing process. Probably people would have got to the point of making cheaper chips and be able to represent more sequences on them. But obviously at this point, DNA sequencing developed, and so people stopped developing this kind of alternative approach, and we just moved to ChIP-seq, which is basically the same thing. It's performing regular chip, just like we discussed. You start with your cross-link material, you break it by sonication, and then you are interested in reading out all the sequences where your protein of interest is bound. And so you simply sequence every piece of DNA that is coming out of your chip protocol. So you don't have any more to design specific primer for the promoter you are interested in. You just sequence everything that is coming out of from the chip. And then you can go in and interrogate specific promoters, or you can do more genome-wide bioinformatic analysis if that's your goal. So obviously there are lots of advantages to doing sequencing at the end of a chip experiment. First of all, that instead of focusing on single genes that you already know about, you can find out about how the whole genome is regulated. It requires very little material, so the process itself is running a regular chip, but then you get much more information out of it. Problem is still the cost, even though it's much cheaper than the chip-on-chip approach, sequencing is still not completely cheap. And then the analysis, that's the other big limitation, that this kind of experiment is an experiment that gives you a result within a day. You run the chip today, tomorrow you do the PCR, and you can know whether the genes are regulated by certain proteins or not. If you are doing a chip-seq experiment, then you need to run the bioinformatic analysis, and not always you have in the lab the capability of doing all the bioinformatic analysis. Sometimes you have to send them out. So this is the type of reads that you get. As we said before, you have pieces of DNA which attach your protein of interest. That's how you isolate them. And then you, one thing that I forgot to mention all the way. Before you do the PCR, you decross-link, so you get rid of the protein. So after you have finished your immunoprecipitation, when you elute the DNA, you decross-link, so the protein gets detached, and then you recover only the piece of DNA. And then either you run the PCR or you sequence it. Obviously, at this point, the protein is not attached anymore. When you do ChIP-seq, you end up with sequences that are often, that are either on one side of the piece of DNA that you have purified, or the other side. Because as we discussed before, when you sonicate, your aim is to have pieces that are within the 200 to 500, 600 base pair length. When you sequence, you don't sequence 200 base pair. You usually sequence 36, 50 base pair. For chip, usually 36 base pair is more than enough. And so you end up having short reads that align on the two extremities of this piece of DNA. And so what the bioinformatic analysis does is to map all these reads to a reference genome, just like for transcriptomic studies. But then you combine them together into what they are called PIC. So they are PIC calling algorithm that allows you to identify where the transcription factor or your protein of interest binds based on the assembly of all the reads together that belong to one specific piece of DNA. Okay, so if we go back to that simplified model that we introduced at the beginning, where you use CHIP in order to study the interaction between these two type of factors with DNA, one question that you can ask is whether by doing CHIP, you can identify the binding site of a transcription factor, right? So you are working on a new transcription factor, for example. This here is transcription factor X, no one has characterized it yet, and so you don't know what is its binding site. One question that you could ask is, can I use CHIP to identify the transcription factor binding site? And the answer is basically no. So what you identify is the region where this transcription factor binds, and then you can run enrichment analysis that tell you whether certain sequences are enriched underneath the factor that you are studying. So you are immunoprecipitating a bunch of pieces of DNA where this factor binds. If its binding site is CA, 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 for example, that sequence should be enriched in the pieces of DNA that you are isolating, because it should be more represented than other random sequences, right? However, how can I say it? It doesn't tell you that that is the... Maybe I have it here. Yes, I have it here. So, think about it. When you break the... You sonicate the DNA, you sonicate larger pieces, about 200 to 500 base pair. And so the sequences that you identify by ChIP-seq are all across this larger region. So they don't represent only the transcription factor binding site. They represent the area where the transcription factor binding site is. If you run enrichment analysis, you probably find the transcription factor binding site enriched among the ones that you find enriched, but you don't find only that one, because you may be having other transcription factor binding site in the vicinity of this one. Maybe transcription factor X you are interested in often binds together with P53, and so you find also the P53 binding site that is enriched. Or transcription factor X is a neuronal factor, and so it binds to a lot of neuronal genes, and so you find other neuronal specific transcription factor binding site enriched in this region. So that's one limitation, one thing to consider. It's hard to identify new transcription factor binding site response elements through this method. It's a different thing if you already know the transcription factor binding site. So if you are doing an IP for P53, then you can look for the P53 binding site, and you should probably find it enriched in your population, unless P53 is binding through some other mechanism, right? Oh, I forgot this. Okay, so the other thing that you may want to do is to identify not the binding site for the transcription factor itself, but to use the CHIP data to understand which transcription factor are used to recruit a certain cofactor, right? So you are working on a cofactor that is recruited to DNA, you do a CHIP, you find all the location where it binds, but you don't know which is the transcription factor that brings it to DNA. And so you can use the same approach, the one of doing enrichment analysis, and if you find, for example, these three transcription factor binding site, an ER response element, a 4CAD response element, an AP1 response element, you can hypothesize that the cofactor you are interested in is recruited through one of them, okay? If there is only one that is highly enriched and nothing else, then there is a good chance that the cofactor is recruited through that specific transcription factor. But it's not an absolute proof. And so motif analysis is just the beginning. You need to validate the transcription factor binding by other methods. You need to study the functional effect. You need to do sRNA studies. So let's say you chip a cofactor, you find that there is an enrichment for the P53 binding site, and so you think that the cofactor you are interested in is recruited through P53. However, that's only an hypothesis until you prove it. And so one way to prove it, for example, is to remove P53 by sRNA or by other deletion methods and then see if you still find the cofactor recruited to the, through, to the DNA. If it's not recruited any longer, that's a validation of the fact that P53 is needed for the recruitment. If not, then it may be recruited through through something else. The other limitation is that often transcription factor binding sites are specific for a family, not for a specific factor. And so here is an example. The X binding site is pretty conserved among different family members. So if you find an enrichment for X binding in your chip, you still don't know whether it's binding of ELF1, X2, X1, or one of the other many members of this family. This can be a problem for some transcription factor more than others, because there are transcription factor families that are very large. So for example, homeodomain transcription factors, there are more than 200 factors in the same family. So if you find an homeodomain binding site enriched in your chip sequence, it doesn't really tell you much because there could be 200 different factors that bind there. If you are working with STAT or GATA, for example, those are much smaller family. There may be one or two members, so you can do sRNA analysis, delete one by one, and then see which one is the important one. Okay, so the other, once you go, the other thing that you can do with ChIP-seq data is to integrate the ChIP-seq data from your experiment with other data. So you perform your chip, you analyze all the tags, you align them, you get peaks, and then you work, you do enrichment studies, and you find certain transcription factor binding site being enriched under your the binding of your factor of interest. You can look at this in isolation, or you can combine the results of your experiment with other data sets that are available. And so here are a couple of examples from work in my lab. So one thing you can do is that you can overlap the ChIP-seq data of your factor with ChIP-seq data with of other factors. And one possibility is not to redo your experiment yourself, but to use ChIP-seq data that are already available out there. So this is what we did for this particular study. The factor we are interested in is called GPS2. And we were interested to know whether it would overlap with factors, other cofactors that are called ANCOR, SMART, or with transcription factor like RXR or PPR gamma. And so we downloaded the ChIP-seq data and we overlapped them. And if you compare them, you can see these are data from differentiating adipocytes. So day zero are the undifferentiated cells and day four are the differentiated cells. And so you can see in this heat map, where each line is a gene, that there is good binding, overlapping of binding of GPS2 with ANCOR in undifferentiated cells, but then the overlapping is lost when cell differentiated. And that's an interesting observation, right? The opposite is true for some transcription factor. There is no overlapping at all at day zero, where there is good overlapping at day six. So this is one example of integration data with other data sets. Another example of integration is not looking at single genes. So these are heat maps. So just like we discussed when we were looking at microarrays, when you use heat maps, you can really look at each single gene. So each line represents a gene. And then you're looking at how the population as a whole is regulated. Or you can do some meta-analysis where you combine all the data from all the genes together and see what that looks like. And so here the ChIP-seq data are represented in terms of distance from the TSS, and they are, and these are normalized tag density for all the ChIP-seq data together, right? For all the genes. And so what you can see here is that the binding of GPS2 is more shifted towards the right of the TSS, whereas the binding of transcription factor like RXR and PPR gamma is more shifted toward the left. And so these, for example, tell you that in this particular setup, this cofactor is not recruited through RXR and PPR gamma because they bind in two different places. One bind downstream of the TSS, the other one bind upstream of the TSS. Okay, so the question is whether there is a lot of data available for this kind of integration analysis, and the answer is yes, there is tons of it, more and more and more. The limitation is only to have the bioinformatic capability to analyze it, and space on the computer, on server to download all these terabytes of data. The majority of the data that is available come from the ENCODE project. We have already discussed it at length, but we have focused mostly on the transcriptomic aspect of the ENCODE. However, we discussed the fact that within ENCODE, people also studied protein-DNA interaction. So if you go on the ENCODE website and look at the different tracks, I don't know if you remember, there is an entire chapter that is dedicated to protein-DNA interaction. And what they have done is that they have run ChIP-seq, so this is the one up here, I think, the ChIP-seq here. So they've run ChIP-seq for a large number of transcription factors in many, many different cell lines. And so you can download all the data from the ENCODE project. The other website where a lot of data is deposited is the SISTROM. SISTROM is more of a, I think it's more of a European website, but there are a lot of ChIP-seq data that are deposited here. And then there is just almost every ChIP-seq that has been performed and published, the data is deposited at the NCBI, the Geo Expression Database. And so this is the page from one of our data sets. When you publish, you need to deposit all the raw data of your ChIP-seq data, of your ChIP-seq experiment. And so other people can just go to the Geo website, download the data. If you click here where the samples are, you can download the basically the FASTQ files that come out of the RNA sequencer and reanalyze them as you like. The beauty about the SISTROM is that instead of having to reanalyze them, they are already aligned them to the genome reference. So you can just browse or encode the same. You can browse the browser, and I know you are gonna do a workshop on how to browse all these databases and see where things are binding. Whereas if you look at data that is published in single papers, then you have to download it and reanalyze it yourself. But this is basically what we have done for a lot of the things that I showed you here. So the ChIP-seq data for ENCORE and SMART come from these two papers, the one for PPR gamma from this other one. And so we downloaded their data and reanalyzed them. Okay, I think with this we are done with the physical interaction. So again, remember that the techniques that we have looked at right now are all techniques that tells you whether things physically interact or where in the genome a protein is binding. It doesn't tell you anything about the function. So the fact that a protein is binding to a certain location on the genome doesn't mean that it's doing something, right? So we need different approaches to study the functional relevance of these interactions. And so a classic way is to do RNA expression studies like we studied last week. Look at the transcriptome, do RNA-seq experiment, or look at single genes. However, there are a couple of other techniques that really allows you to study the functional effect of protein-DNA interaction. So not just general changes in RNA expression, but changes that are due to that specific protein-DNA interaction event. And so the first thing is using a reporter assay. I'm sure you are all familiar with it. The idea is to use a reporter gene that it can be seen somehow, so either it emits light or it produces an enzymatic activity that can be detected. And then upstream of this reporter gene, you can put the sequence you are interested in. And so either a transcription factor binding site or a piece of a promoter. And so you transfect everything in a cell, and then you study whether this is expressed. And you can study whether the expression of this reporter gene is modulated by different extracellular stimuli. You give ligand, you give drugs, and you see how that change. The other thing you can do is that you can insert mutation here, and so see whether mutation on specific binding site will change the expression of your reporter gene. Strength is that it's easy to do. They can be used for high throughput experiment. So for chemical screening, for example, drug screening, they are widely used. And they have a large dynamic range. You can use them with different reporters. Here I have an example is one of the reporter for the luciferase gene. Luciferase is probably the most common one that you find in papers, where the reporter gene expresses the enzyme luciferase. When you give the right substrate to it, it will emit light and can be read through a luminometer. And so the reporter is made in such a way that the luciferase gene has an upstream cloning site where you can insert your region of interest. And so you can insert a real promoter or a small binding site with or without Tata box and make all the different permutations that you are interested in. Other examples are beta-gal, GFP for in vivo studies. An old one that now it's not used anymore, it's CAT, the CAT assay. Same idea, it was just read on an autoradiograph membrane. But you may find it in papers, and it's exactly the same thing that running a luciferase assay. It's just a different enzymatic readout. Weaknesses, the main weakness is that it relies on transfection. So because this is an artificial piece of DNA, exogenous piece of DNA that you have to insert in the cells, it works with cells that can be easily transfected. If you're working with neurons or other cells that are hard to transfect, it could be a problem. And the other thing is that it's a plasmid, right? So it's not inserted in the chromatin environment. And so there have been long-standing debate of how reasonable it is to study cofactor function, transcriptional regulation on plasmid, where most of the enzymatic activities that are brought in by cofactors are histone acetylation, histone deacetylation, histone methylation, and in this kind of setup, you don't have histone that can be modified. So it can give you some information about transcriptional regulation, but it's important to keep in mind the limitation of the assay. Okay, here is an example of in vivo studies. That's one of the other advantages of this approach, that you can use it for in vivo experiments. And so usually for in vivo, people prefer to use either LAC-Z or GFP reporters. LAC-Z you have to stain, GFP can be visualized on live embryos, live animals. And the type of experiment you do are the same one that you can do in a cell with a reporter. So for example, you can do promoter deletion experiments, where in this particular paper they were interested in finding which region of this promoter, the SPRPK3 promoter, was important for the expression of the gene SRPK3 in the embryo. And so they use different deletion, and they identify the minimal promoter, which is 0.4, I think, KB, which is required. And then they see that within this small region there are different transcription factor binding sites. So they delete them one by one in order to identify which one is important for the expression. Same thing here in fish with LAC-Z. you can make different deletion, and it's just a matter of cloning a vector in vitro and then introducing it in the embryo or in the cell type. As I said, it can be used for high throughput screening. So if you have, for luciferase, it's easy to set up high throughput screening where you can read 396 well plates on a luminometer. And so in each well, you can introduce a different chemical drugs or a different siRNA and see what's the effect of altering gene by gene is having on the expression of that specific reporter. The other thing that can be done is to use artificial transcription factor. So this approach is it's like a variation of a yeast hybrid. So in the yeast hybrid, you use a bait that is binding to a specific response element on DNA to test the interaction with a prey, right? And so you have a library that express all different Y proteins, and then you want to see whether Y interact with, what are the all the Ys that interact with X. And so you run this as a reporter system. You get transcription of the reporter only when X interact with Y, because the DNA binding domain of the transcription factor is separated from the activation domain. And so only when they are brought together, then you get activation of the reporter. So this has been used in a lot of papers to test protein-protein interaction or identify new protein that interacts with the bait. And then finally, the last approach that can be used and has been widely used to study transcriptional regulation is in vitro transcription. So this is a different approach. It's not done in vivo in cells, but it allows you to study the transcription of a small transcription unit in vitro. And so you can really, it's like a reconstitution system where you have a piece of DNA, and then you make it so that it's upstream of it, there is a regulatory region you are studying, for example, a piece of promoter. And then you can reconstitute the whole transcription event by adding things piece by piece. So you add the nucleotide, you can add nuclear extract that have the whole machinery, or you can add recombinant proteins. And so you can add purified components separated. You can add only RNA pol 2 or RNA pol 2 plus different cofactors and see which is the minimal unit that can drive transcription. So it's basically a reconstituted transcription in vitro in test tubes, which is then run on a gel. It's labeled, so you see the piece of DNA that has been the RNA that has been transcribed, and you see transcription only if the machinery that you have provided is sufficient to drive the transcriptional event. And so you use GLS cassette just to avoid termination at random. But the basic idea is that you have a small transcribed cassette and you look at the transcription in vitro. There are some more recent development of the same approach where instead of using just a piece of DNA, oligo DNA, people have tried to reconstitute a more physiological template by either making the DNA super coiled so that it's reminiscent of the organization of the DNA in vivo and therefore allows to test enzymatic activity like the necessity of a DNA helicase and things like that. Or there have been modifications in which people have tried to use a chromatinized template. So make that small piece of DNA, make it into a chromatinized template which is loaded onto a nucleosome so that you also have histone there and you can assess the necessity of histone chromatin remodeling enzyme. But the basic concept is always the same. What changes is the substrate, the template, which is either just the naked DNA or a supercoiled DNA or a DNA in a chromatin environment. And then you add the different purified component and look at whether transcription can occur or not. And with this, I think we're done. I don't know, early or late? Finish a little early. Any questions? Okay, so I'll see you this afternoon and we'll start to see how some of this technique have been used to study transcriptional regulation. We'll start from the beginning, from the promoters. Okay, so let me get a little bit better into how you read out the result of a chip, because I think I was pretty fast at the end on the control, so it may have been a little bit confusing. And anyway, we needed to move forward to the global screening method. So the basic readout of a chip experiment, a normal hand chip experiment, is a PCR. And the idea is that you start with the protocol as we discussed before. You are interested in knowing where a certain protein binds. So you sonicate the chromatin, immunoprecipitate pieces of DNA that are attached to your protein of interest by doing an immunoprecipitation for an antibody. And then the question is, how do you evaluate whether the protein binds to a certain gene or not? And so what we used to do at the beginning was to interrogate single genes. So you were interested in knowing whether protein X was bound to the promoter of a certain gene, for example, gene A and gene B. And so you do the chip as we discussed, we immunoprecipitate using an antibody against protein X. First you sonicate, so you sonicate pieces of DNA that hopefully are small enough, like this. And then you wanna see whether the protein is bound to your gene of interest. And so you design specific primers that will amplify the region that you are interested in. And so you design a couple of primers that amplify this specific promoter, another couple of primers, so this is one and two, another couple of primers, three and four, that amplify this other gene that you are interested in, and then another couple of primers that amplify an unrelated region of the genome that has nothing to do with gene A and gene B, and these are five and six, okay? And so the first way to do it was to take the material that you get at the end of the old chip protocol and then run a PCR with this primer, and this primer. Now, if the result was a gel like this, where one and two was giving you a band, three and four was not giving you anything, or maybe a little faint signal, and then five and six, the same. The way to interpret this experiment was, okay, my protein is binding to gene A, to the promoter of gene A, but it's not binding to the promoter of gene B. And the experiment worked well. This binding is probably specific because if I amplify a region that is unrelated, I don't get any signal. So that was the initial way to assess the result of a chip. Now, the limitation of this approach is that you can look only at a limited number of genes, two, three, maybe four. The chip reaction at the end is eluted in about 25, 50 microliter, so you finish up your material pretty fast by doing PCRs. You cannot test more than three, four genes, okay? So people realize pretty quickly that there was a wealth of information in this chip material, but we were analyzing only a very limited amount of it. Because in the material that you had immunoprecipitated, there was basically every single region in the genome that was bound to your protein of interest. But you were analyzing only two, three genes that you were interested in. All the rest of the information was lost. And so people started immediately, within a year or two, to try to develop ways to interrogate the binding of the protein of interest to the whole genome, to read what the information that was encoded, that was present in your tube at the end of the chip. And so a different number of approaches were developed. One first way to do it was to use microarrays and hybridize all these pieces of DNA that you were getting out of the chip protocol to a microarray and see where these sequences would hybridize. So this was called chip-on-chip and was initially pretty popular. One of the problems, this is a similar approach where people were adapting the technology that we discussed the other day for CAGE and SAGE, where you take all the sequences that you get from your cDNA library prep and then you concatenize them into plasmid and sequence them. And this was also tried as a way to read out all the chip results. The main limitation of these approaches was the cost. So when I was a grad student, there were a few postdocs in my lab that worked on setting up chip-on-chip in the lab. And the main problem was the printing of this chip, because basically you needed to print homemade chips where oligos that represented all regulatory regions in the cells were printed. So first of all, this was not a real genome-wide approach, because only the sequences that were printed on the array could be interrogated, but also because printing chips with all these oligos costed a fortune. And so basically there were grants that were written just to print the microarray. So this was a developing process. Probably people would have got to the point of making cheaper chips and be able to represent more sequences on them. But obviously, at this point, DNA sequencing developed, and so people stopped developing this kind of alternative approach, and we just moved to ChIP-seq, which is basically the same thing. It's performing regular chip, just like we discussed. You start with your cross-linked material, you break it by sonication, and then you are interested in reading out all the sequences where your protein of interest is bound. And so you simply sequence every piece of DNA that is coming out of your chip protocol. So you don't have any more to design a specific primer for the promoter you are interested in. You just sequence everything that is coming out of from the chip. And then you can go in and interrogate specific promoters, or you can do more genome-wide bioinformatic analysis if that's your goal. So obviously there are lots of advantages to doing sequencing at the end of a chip experiment. First of all, that instead of focusing on single genes that you already know about, you can find out about how the whole genome is regulated. It requires very little material, so the process itself is running a regular chip, but then you get much more information out of it. Problem is still the cost, even though it's much cheaper than the chip-on-chip approach. Sequencing is still not completely cheap. And then the analysis, that's the other big limitation, that this kind of experiment is an experiment that gives you a result within a day. You run the chip today, tomorrow you do the PCR, and you can know whether the genes are regulated by certain proteins or not. If you are doing a chip-seq experiment, then you need to run the bioinformatic analysis, and not always you have in the lab the capability of doing all the bioinformatic analysis. Sometimes you have to send them out. So this is the type of reads that you get. As we said before, you have pieces of DNA with attached your protein of interest. That's how you isolate them. And then you, one thing that I forgot to mention all the way, before you do the PCR, you decross-link, so you get rid of the protein. So after you have finished your immunoprecipitation, when you elute the DNA, you decross-link, so the protein gets detached, and then you recover only the piece of DNA. And then either you run the PCR or you sequence it. Obviously, at this point, the protein is not attached anymore. When you do ChIP-seq, you end up with sequences that are often, that are either on one side of the piece of DNA that you have purified or the other side. Because the, as we discussed before, when you sonicate, your aim is to have pieces that are within the 200 to 500, 600 base pair length. When you sequence, you don't sequence 200 base pair. You usually sequence 36, 50 base pair. For ChIP, usually 36 base pair is more than enough. And so you end up having short reads that align on the two extremities of this piece of DNA. And so what the bioinformatic analysis does is to map all these reads to a reference genome, just like for transcriptomic studies. But then you combine them together into what they are called PEEK. So they are PEEK calling algorithm that allows you to identify where the transcription factor or your protein of interest binds based on the assembly of all the reads together that belong to one specific piece of DNA. Okay, so if we go back to that simplified model that we introduced at the beginning, where you use ChIP in order to study the interaction between these two type of factors with DNA, one question that you can ask is whether by doing ChIP you can identify the binding site of a transcription factor, right? So you are working on a new transcription factor, for example. This here is transcription factor X, no one has characterized it yet, and so you don't know what is its binding site. One question that you could ask is, can I use ChIP to identify the transcription factor binding site? And the answer is basically no. So what you identify is the region where this transcription factor binds, and then you can run enrichment analysis that tell you whether certain sequences are enriched underneath the factor that you are studying. So you are immunoprecipitating a bunch of pieces of DNA where this factor binds. If its binding site is CA, 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 for example, that sequence should be enriched in the pieces of DNA that you are isolating, because it should be more represented than other random sequences, right? However, how can I say it? It doesn't tell you that that is the... Maybe I have it here. Yes, I have it here. So, think about it. When you break the... You sonicate the DNA, you sonicate larger pieces, about 200 to 500 base pair. And so the sequences that you identify by ChIP-seq are all across this larger region. So they don't represent only the transcription factor binding site. They represent the area where the transcription factor binding site is. If you run enrichment analysis, you probably find the transcription factor binding site enriched among the ones that you find enriched, but you don't find only that one, because you may be having other transcription factor binding site in the vicinity of this one. Maybe transcription factor X you are interested in often binds together with P53, and so you find also the P53 binding site that is enriched. Or transcription factor X is a neuronal factor, and so it binds to a lot of neuronal genes, and so you find other neuronal specific transcription factor binding site enriched in this region. So that's one limitation, one thing to consider. It's hard to identify new transcription factor binding site response elements through this method. It's a different thing if you already know the transcription factor binding site. So if you know, if you are doing an IP for P53, then you can look for the P53 binding site, and you should probably find it enriched in your population, unless P53 is binding through some other mechanism, right? I forgot this. Okay, so the other thing that you can, you may want to do is to identify not the binding site for the transcription factor itself, but to use the chip data to understand which transcription factor are used to recruit a certain cofactor, right? So you are working on a cofactor that is recruited to DNA, you do a chip, you find all the location where it binds, but you don't know which is the transcription factor that brings it to DNA. And so you can use the same approach, the one of doing enrichment analysis, and if you find, for example, this three transcription factor binding site, an ER response element, a 4CAD response element, an AP1 response element, you can hypothesize that the cofactor you are interested in is recruited through one of them, okay? If there is only one that is highly enriched and nothing else, then there is a good chance that the cofactor is recruited through that specific transcription factor, but it's not an absolute proof. And so motif analysis is just the beginning. You need to validate the transcription factor binding by other methods. You need to study the functional effect. You need to do sRNA studies. So let's say you chip a cofactor, you find that there is an enrichment for the P53 binding site, and so you think that the cofactor you are interested in is recruited through P53. However, that's only an hypothesis until you prove it. And so one way to prove it, for example, is to remove P53 by sRNA or by other deletion methods, and then see if you still find the cofactor recruited to the DNA. If it's not recruited any longer, that's a validation of the fact that P53 is needed for the recruitment. If not, then it may be recruited through something else. The other limitation is that often transcription factor binding sites are specific for a family, not for a specific factor. And so here is an example. The X binding site is pretty conserved among different family members. So if you find an enrichment for X binding in your chip, you still don't know whether it's binding of ELF1, X2, X1, or one of the other many members of this family. This can be a problem for some transcription factor more than others, because there are transcription factor families that are very large. So for example, homeodomain transcription factors, there are more than 200 factors in the same family. So if you find an homeodomain binding site enriched in your chip sequence, it doesn't really tell you much, because there could be 200 different factors that bind there. If you are working with STAT or GATA, for example, those are much smaller family. There may be one or two members, so you can do sRNA analysis, delete one by one, and then see which one is the important one. Okay, so the other, once you go, the other thing that you can do with ChIP-seq data is to integrate the ChIP-seq data from your experiment with other data. So you perform your chip, you analyze all the tags, you align them, you get peaks, and then you work, you do enrichment studies, and you find certain transcription factor binding site being enriched under your the binding of your factor of interest. You can look at this in isolation, or you can combine the results of your experiment with other data sets that are available. And so here are a couple of examples from work in my lab. So one thing you can do is that you can overlap the ChIP-seq data of your factor with ChIP-seq data with of other factors. And one possibility is not to redo your experiment yourself, but to use ChIP-seq data that are already available out there. So this is what we did for this particular study. The factor we are interested in is called GPS2, and we were interested to know whether it would overlap with factors, other cofactors that are called ANGOR, SMART, or with transcription factor like RXR or PPR gamma. And so we downloaded the ChIP-seq data and we overlapped them. And if you compare them, you can see these are data from differentiating adipocytes. So day zero are the undifferentiated cells and day four are the differentiated cells. And so you can see in this heat map where each line is a gene that there is good binding, overlapping of binding of GPS2 with ANCOR in undifferentiated cells, but then the overlapping is lost when cell differentiated. And that's an interesting observation, right? The opposite is true for some transcription factor. There is no overlapping at all at day zero, where there is good overlapping at day six. So this is one example of integration data with other data sets. Another example of integration is not looking at single genes. So these are heat maps. So just like we discussed when we were looking at microarrays, when you use heat maps, you can really look at each single gene. So each line represents a gene. And then you're looking at how the population as a whole is regulated. Or you can do some meta-analysis where you combine all the data from all the genes together and see what that looks like. And so here the ChIP-seq data are represented in terms of distance from the TSS, and they are, and these are normalized tag density for all the ChIP-seq data together, right? For all the genes. And so what you can see here is that the binding of GPS2 is more shifted towards the right of the TSS, whereas the binding of transcription factor like RXR and PPR gamma is more shifted toward the left. And so these, for example, tell you that in this particular setup, this cofactor is not recruited through RXR and PPR gamma because they bind in two different places. One binds downstream of the TSS, the other one binds upstream of the TSS. Okay, so the question is whether there is a lot of data available for this kind of integration analysis. And the answer is yes, there is tons of it, more and more and more. The limitation is only to have the bioinformatic capability to analyze it and space on the computer, on server to download all these terabytes of data. The majority of the data that is available come from the ENCODE project. We have already discussed it at length, but we have focused mostly on the transcriptomic aspect of the ENCODE. However, we discussed the fact that within ENCODE, people also studied protein-DNA interaction. So if you go on the ENCODE website and look at the different tracks, I don't know if you remember, there is an entire chapter that is dedicated to protein-DNA interaction. And what they have done is that they have run ChIP-seq, so this is the one up here, I think, the ChIP-seq here. So they have run ChIP-seq for a large number of transcription factors in many, many different cell lines. And so you can download all the data from the ENCODE project. The other website where a lot of data is deposited is the SISTROM. SISTROM is more of a, I think it's more of a European website, but there are a lot of ChIP-seq data that are deposited here. And then there is just almost every ChIP-seq that has been performed and published, the data is deposited at the NCBI, the Geo Expression Database. And so this is the page from one of our data sets. When you publish, you need to deposit all the raw data of your ChIP-seq data, of your ChIP-seq experiment. And so other people can just go to the Geo website, download the data. If you click here where the samples are. You can download the basically the FASTQ files that come out of the RNA sequencer and reanalyze them as you like. The beauty about the Cistrom is that instead of having to reanalyze them, they are already aligned them to the genome reference, so you can just browse or encode the same. You can browse the browser, and I know you are going to do a workshop on how to browse all these databases and see where things are binding. Whereas if you look at data that is published in single papers, then you have to download it and reanalyze it yourself. But this is basically what we have done for a lot of the things that I showed you here. So the ChIP-seq data for ANCHOR and SMART come from these two papers, the one for PPR gamma from this other one. And so we downloaded their data and reanalyzed them. Okay, I think with this we are done with the physical interaction. So again, remember that the techniques that we have looked at right now are all techniques that tells you whether things physically interact or where in the genome a protein is binding. It doesn't tell you anything about the function. So the fact that a protein is binding to a certain location on the genome doesn't mean that it's doing something, right? So we need different approaches to study the functional relevance of these interactions. And so a classic way is to do RNA expression studies like we studied last week. Look at the transcriptome. Do RNA-seq experiment or look at single genes. However, there are a couple of other techniques that really allows you to study the functional effect of protein-DNA interaction. So not just general changes in RNA expression, but changes that are due to that specific protein-DNA interaction event. And so the first thing is using a reporter assay. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. The idea is to use a reporter gene that it can be seen somehow, so either it emits light or it produces an enzymatic activity that can be detected. And then upstream of this reporter gene, you can put the sequence you are interested in. And so either a transcription factor binding site or a piece of a promoter. And so you transfect everything in a cell, and then you study whether this is expressed. And you can study whether the expression of this reporter gene is modulated by different extracellular stimuli. You give ligand, you give drugs, and you see how that change. The other thing you can do is that you can insert mutation here, and so see whether mutation on specific binding site will change the expression of your reporter gene. Strength is that it's easy to do. They can be used for high throughput experiment, so for chemical screening, for example, drug screening, they are widely used, and they have a large dynamic range. You can use them with different reporters. Here I have an example, is one of the reporters for the luciferase gene. Luciferase is probably the most common one that you find in papers, where the reporter gene expresses the enzyme luciferase. When you give the right substrate to it, it will emit light and can be read through a luminometer. And so the reporter is made in such a way that the luciferase gene has an upstream cloning site where you can insert your region of interest. And so you can insert a real promoter or a small binding site, with or without Tata box, and make all the different permutation that you are interested in. Other examples are beta-gal, GFP for in vivo studies. An old one that now it's not used anymore, it's CAT, the CAT assay. Same idea, it was just read on an autoradiograph membrane. But you may find it in papers, and it's exactly the same thing that running a luciferase assay. It's just a different enzymatic readout. Weaknesses, the main weakness is that it relies on transfection. So because this is an artificial piece of DNA, exogenous piece of DNA that you have to insert in the cells, it works with cells that can be easily transfected. If you're working with neurons or other cells that are hard to transfect, that could be a problem. And the other thing is that it's a plasmid, right? So it's not inserted in the chromatin environment. And so there have been long-standing debate of how reasonable it is to study cofactor function, transcriptional regulation on plasmid, where most of the enzymatic activities that are brought in by cofactors are histone acetylation, histone deacetylation, histone methylation, and in this kind of setup, you don't have histone that can be modified. So it can give you some information about transcriptional regulation, but it's important to keep in mind the limitation of the assay. Okay, here is an example of in vivo studies. That's one of the other advantages of this approach, that you can use it for in vivo experiments. And so usually for in vivo, people prefer to use either LAC-Z or GFP reporters. LAC-Z you have to stain, GFP can be visualized on live embryos, live animals. And the type of experiment you do are the same one that you can do in a cell with a reporter. So for example, you can do promoter deletion experiments, where in this particular paper they were interested in finding which region of this promoter, the SPRPK3 promoter, was important for the expression of the gene SRPK3 in the embryo. And so they use different deletion, and they identify the minimal promoter, which is 0.4, I think, KB, which is required. And then they see that within this small region, there are different transcription factor binding sites. So they delete them one by one in order to identify which one is important for the expression. Same thing here in fish with LAC-Z. You can make different deletion, and it's just a matter of cloning a vector in vitro and then introducing it in the embryo or in the cell type. As I said, it can be used for high throughput screening. So if you have, for luciferase, it's easy to set up high throughput screening where you can read 396 well plates on a luminometer. And so in each well, you can introduce a different chemical drugs or a different siRNA and see what's the effect of altering gene by gene is having on the expression of that specific reporter. The other thing that can be done is to use artificial transcription factor. So this approach is it's like a variation of a yeast hybrid. So in the yeast hybrid, you use a bait that is binding to a specific response element on DNA to test the interaction with a prey, right? And so you have a library that expresses all different Y proteins, and then you want to see whether Y interact with what are the all the Ys that interact with X. And so you run this as a reporter system. You get transcription of the reporter only when X interacts with Y, because the DNA binding domain of the transcription factor is separated from the activation domain. And so only when they are brought together, then you get activation of the reporter. So this has been used in a lot of papers to test protein-protein interaction or identify new protein that interacts with the bait. And then finally, the last approach that can be used and has been widely used to study transcriptional regulation is in vitro transcription. So this is a different approach. It's not done in vivo in cells, but it allows you to study the transcription of a small transcription unit in vitro. And so you can really it's like a reconstitution system where you have a piece of DNA, and then you make it so that it's upstream of it there is a regulatory region you are studying, for example, a piece of promoter. And then you can reconstitute the whole transcription event by adding things piece by piece. So you add the nucleotide, you can add nuclear extract that have the whole machinery, or you can add recombinant proteins. And so you can add purified components separated. You can add only RNA-Pol2 or RNA-Pol2 plus different cofactors and see which is the minimal unit that can drive transcription. So it's basically a reconstituted transcription in vitro in test tubes, which is then run on a gel. It's labeled, so you see the piece of DNA that has been the RNA that has been transcribed, and you see transcription only if the machinery that you have provided is sufficient to drive the transcriptional event. And so you use GLAS cassette just to avoid termination at random. But the basic idea is that you have a small transcribed cassette and you look at the transcription in vitro. There are some more recent development of the same approach, where instead of using just a piece of DNA, oligo DNA, people have tried to reconstitute a more physiological template by either making the DNA super coiled so that it's reminiscent of the organization of the DNA in vivo and therefore allows to test enzymatic activity like the necessity of a DNA helicase and things like that. Or there have been modifications in which people have tried to use a chromatinized template, so make that small piece of DNA, make it into a chromatinized template which is loaded onto a nucleosome so that you also have histone there and you can assess the necessity of histone chromatin remodeling enzyme. But the basic concept is always the same. What changes is the substrate, the template, which is either just the naked DNA or a supercoiled DNA or a DNA in a chromatin environment. And then you add the different purified component and look at whether transcription can occur or not. And with this, I think we're done. I don't know, early or late? Finish a little early. Any questions? Okay, so I'll see you this afternoon and we'll start to see how some of this technique have been used to study transcriptional regulation. We'll start from the beginning, from the promoters.